Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for TWiT specials is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiT Live special number 328, recorded Friday, March 9th, 2018 at the Capital One House at South by Southwest. Practical security in a dangerous world. This TWiT Live special is brought to you by Eno, your intelligent assistant from Capital One. Shop online without using your real credit card number for your favorite merchant sites. For more information, visit CapitalOne.com/Eno/virtual numbers. Welcome to our TWiT Live special. We are live at South by Southwest. We're at the Capital One House at Antone's on 5th Street. And it is a really good morning to everybody. I think we are probably the first event at South by Southwest. God, there can't be anybody starting earlier than this. It's 8:30 in the morning on day one of South by's interactive festival. And we're really grateful to Capital One for inviting us to kick off their program. They have a full week of programs here at the Capital One House. A beautiful place. We've put together a panel, and I want to thank Stacey Higginbotham, my compadre from This Week in Google. We've put together a panel that I think is going to be very interesting. We talk on TWiT all the time, especially on shows like Security Now, about terrifying stuff. If you were just to watch that show, I call it the Tinfoil Hat Brigade, you would just get offline. You would say, I'm not using a computer ever again. You'd move to a cabin in the woods. But I thought it'd be really good to do something we don't often do, and I think even the mainstream media doesn't often do, which is talk about what's real, what's not real, and what you should be doing about it to secure yourself, a normal person. People who are watching this are probably not normal. I acknowledge that. I understand. You are mostly geeks and very interested and enthusiastic in technology. But I think you also have this issue of telling friends and family what's real and what's not real. I had a call on the radio show the other day from a young woman who had a computer she built herself with a motherboard that hadn't been updated for Spectre and Meltdown. And, you know, she was using Windows 10, so it had been updated, but she had run a program that said your BIOS is not up to date. And she knew that she wasn't going to get a BIOS update because it was a four-year-old motherboard. She stopped using the computer. And I said, use the computer. I don't think Spectre is going to bite you anytime soon. So I think that's what we're kind of here to talk about. Let me introduce our panel. We've got a great panel. Wendy Nather is here. She's with Duo Security, which is, I've used Duo in the past as two-factor authentication for my LastPass, for instance. I love Duo. She's Advisory Chief Information Security Officer. Do you pronounce that CISO or CISO?
I have a team of advisory CISOs.
CISOs?
Yeah, you're going to find a lot of people who are going to argue and die on that hill of how to pronounce CISO.
But you're going to say CISO,
I'm going to say CISO.
You were a CISO yourself in both public and private sectors. Mm-hmm. She's past research director at the retail ISAC.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I got that one right.
There you go.
Yep, and at the analyst from 451 Research. Wendy, it's really nice to have you.
Thank you.
Now, you're going to have to think in terms of not CISOs, but real people today and what real people
do. You know, if I meet any, I'll let you know.
We'll find some somewhere. Bo Woods is also here. Bo, we're going to give him a little pass because he had to drive from Dallas last night because he couldn't get a straight flight into Austin. I guess the weather back east was thousands of flights were canceled.
Yeah, there was bad weather, but also this particular plane had mechanical issues. And, you know, being in the business of thinking about what could go wrong with connected technology, my mind immediately went to, you know,
we've been hacked.
Is this one of my friends pranking me and keeping me away from South By? But eventually got here at 4:30 in the morning. And so I'm a little bit sleep deprived, but caffeine rich.
Welcome. It's good to have you. And I want to give people your background. Bo is a cyber safety innovation fellow for the Scowcroft Center for Strategy and Security, cyber safety innovation fellow with the Atlantic Council, but a leader with, and I have to ask you about this, the I Am the Cavalry grassroots initiative.
Yep.
What is, and it's founder and CEO of Stratego Security as well. What is I Am the Cavalry?
So Eye on the Cavalry grows out of a realization from the security research community, the hacker community, several years ago that our dependence on connected technology is growing faster than our ability to secure it. And as we look forward to all the promise of this great technology, like connected medical devices, regenerative medicine, automated driving, and other things, the fear or distrust in those technologies might lead us to move back to less secure, less safe technologies. So we want to preserve trust through building trustworthiness into those systems.
Yeah, Stacey Higginbotham's kind of on the front line of that because she covers Internet of Things technology, which is right now, correct me if I'm wrong, it seems to be the biggest potential problem in security in the home anyway.
Well, in the home, I would say medical devices.
Yeah, you don't want your pacemaker. Stacey is the host of the Internet of Things podcast with Kevin Toefel. She also does a really great newsletter, which everybody should subscribe to, the Internet of Things newsletter. And that's at StaceyOnIoT.com. And, of course, Stacey and I are on This Week in Google every Wednesday with Jeff Jarvis on our Twit network.
Double whoop.
So I understand that there is a lot of bad stuff out there. We hear a lot about Meltdown Inspector. Minecraft's bad, but that's for another reason entirely. We hear about the Equifax breaches, and I guess Equifax revealed, oh yeah, there's another couple of million names in the.
Yeah.
And I think consumers, when they hear this, freak out. But I wonder how much they should be worried about. Let's start with these breaches. Target, Minecraft. Minecraft has not been breached. Target, I got Minecraft on the brain. It's a little early for me right now.
Do you want me to go topical? We could start out with something different if you want.
Yeah, what's top? Is there something current?
Well, let's start with...
That just happened?
I'm going to do it. So there's some...
Call it an Echo.
An Echo. Oh, thank you. Yeah. Okay. So let's start with the Echo, which a lot of people are worried about because they're like, Amazon is listening in. And then just this week, it started laughing at people in a crazy kind of scary way.
This is a perfect example of what our friend Jeff would call techno panic, right? Because you can ask, you tell me if I'm wrong, but you can ask the Echo to laugh. And it will laugh in a kind of creepy way, admittedly.
It doesn't laugh like that, though. It has never laughed.
It doesn't laugh like that?
No.
So this is a different laugh people are hearing?
This is a different laugh.
Okay, that is creepy.
See? So, and the laugh is only like what's hot right now, but really.
But all it is really is the Echo thinks you asked it to laugh and it's laughing, right? It's not.
We don't know what it is.
It's not Jeff Bezos secretly in his lab, you know, his mountainous. Evil genius lab pressing a button saying, let's scare Stacy.
No, because I'm not that. The world doesn't revolve around me. But I'm using this as an example of we have the idea that we're adding connectivity to things and security hasn't kept up. And there's a lot of people, 20% of the U.S. households have an Echo now, apparently. But there's still 80%, and I bet a lot of them are like,
That's
not secure. I'm not putting that in my
head. Well, and the laugh story it enhances that, but I wonder if the laugh thing is really something people should worry about. Is that real security issue, or is that just Echo kind of acting funny?
I don't know, but I was thinking we could talk about security fears in the for the normal people.
I notice I have now in my house and outside my house cameras everywhere. I have cameras in my car. I have microphones everywhere. I carry a camera and microphone in my pocket that has also, incidentally, always connected Internet and GPS. Should we worry about this, Bo, or is this your hacker friends? Yeah. What are they saying?
Well, my hacker friends are a little bit divided. Some of them won't trust technology. I know some folks in the community who still carry a pager.
Really?
And that's it. Yeah.
Are they drug dealers too?
No. Although I've heard that. Somebody said AI has side effects just like drugs do.
Yeah.
So maybe they are drug dealers in a way.
Yeah.
The other half are really embracing the technology, partially because they want to hack it and extend the capabilities into other things.
Yeah.
But what worries me equally as much as adversaries who are specifically targeting someone or who indiscriminately, you know, attack the entire internet is the case of accidents. And this Echo issue, the funny Echo, seems to be an accident, we think. One of the great things about machine learning and artificial intelligence is no one can say why something happens, just the computers tell it to.
That's good news. That's really good news.
Yeah.
You don't want a non-deterministic computer. That's not good, right?
Yeah. Right. Well,
isn't it ultimately deterministic, though? It's just, it's all programming somewhere.
In some sense, it's deterministic. In some sense, though, it's non-deterministic, right?
So it's fuzzy logic.
It's
kind
fuzzy
of stuff.
Logic. It's strange interactions. It's unintended consequences. Yeah. You know, all software has flaws.
Right.
It's a natural consequence of developing code. Even when NASA tries to make perfect code, they still can't. Right. So we have these unintended consequences, and sometimes those manifest in security issues, cybersecurity vulnerabilities. Sometimes they manifest in accidents.
Laughing.
And including laughing.
So we should be concerned about echo laughing.
That I would say we should be concerned about that type of issue.
Amazon needs to say what's going on,
where it comes from.
Yeah,
right?
Why is it? If there's a, if it's just like, oh well, you can look, can't you, and see if Echo thought you said laugh for me.
People showed their apps when it happened to them, and they looked to see what happened, and there was nothing in their.
So it's just spontaneous laughter.
It is.
Do you have an Echo in your house, Wendy? Do you let those things in your house?
I do not, although I was just thinking if I had an Echo and I really wanted to mess with my own head, I would make it sound like my teenagers. Because instead of laughing, they would go, really?
Really?
Seriously?
Whatever.
Mom. And that would freak me out a lot more than the laughter.
I don't know. Creepy laughter. And they're saying it's childlike, or it sounds like a woman and it sounds distant.
It's short. Ha, ha, ha. Or no, that's not right.
Well, that's good, though.
Now we know that Stacy's not the one doing it.
A lot of echoes at home just went, what? I hear my friend.
That's going to be my new Twitter ringtone.
Ha, ha, ha.
Ha, ha, ha.
All right. So that's it. But it's a perfect example of people can freak out about that. And that is freaky because we've seen too many horror movies where that's a sign that there's a ghost or something, right? But in a rationalistic world, is it something we should worry about, or is it just a flaw in the software?
I think we should worry about it. I mean, the idea that we've got computers that are about to be controlling our driving, that are, gosh, you know, tracking manufacturing processes, and they're still glitchy, that I feel like is a problem. I need them to be more secure.
That's a big deal if the Echo's glitchy. Worst case scenario, it orders a dollhouse you didn't want, right? I mean, seriously.
So I read something this morning that was really great. It said there's a new genre of fiction coming along that is Black Mirror meets HGTV. And it reminds me of a paper that I wrote at the Atlanta Council a couple of years ago with some other folks where we did a story, a very, very short story. We called it A Digital Haunted House. The idea was that these types of things in the future become entirely routine through accidents, through adversaries, through contract negotiation breakdowns between, for instance, Amazon and Google, which
right. That's going on right now.
Right. Yep. So in the future, we have to look at this. I see a couple of different potential pathways. One is like the Jetsons future, where everything pretty much works very reliably. And the other is the Futurama, where nothing works right. Well. Everything works in unintended ways, but we're still kind of all right with it.
Right.
But it's not the promise that we imagine.
I think we already know which future we're headed to.
I think we do, too. And, you know, I look forward to our robot overlords.
Well, I think the problem is I wouldn't encourage people to be afraid of, you know, the Skynet or that kind of thing. I think the problem is more that we don't understand our own programming all that well. And since we are the ones that are building this technology, we're building in not only flaws but also biases. Which we see a lot with AI. When you're putting in historical information to train something through machine learning and you have a biased history, that's what you're going to be programming in. So I think there are a lot of things that we need to examine about ourselves at the same time before we can trust what we build.
Yeah, we kind of assume, well, it's a computer, it's not biased. In fact, it's the ultimate unbiased thing, but that's really a naive view of how a computer works.
No, it reflects exactly what we put into it, of our flaws, all of our fears, all of our biases.
We are, this is great. I'm glad everybody in the live studio, it's not really a studio, in the Capital One House is here and at Antone's. I'm thrilled to have a live audience watching on the internet, and those of you watching the podcast, we're glad that you're watching, and so glad to have Stacy Higginbotham and Wendy Nather and Bo Woods here. We're going to continue our conversation in a bit, but I have to thank our hosts today for the breakfast tacos. Did you get some?
They were delicious.
Okay.
Yeah.
Were they appropriately sourced?
They were appropriately sourced.
Okay.
That was part of my, there was a rider in my contract.
That was her, it was her rider. Yeah, they have to be from the Taco Deli. Our show today brought to you by Capital One and their intelligent assistant, Eno, E-N-O. And I just learned, you guys are cagey, that that's one backwards.
I was thinking of Brian Eno.
I mean, me too.
Here we are.
Me too. And see, that's what we were talking about earlier. I'm just glad it wasn't Lapitac because or Latipac because that wouldn't have really been.
Eno is
much better, right? So Eno is doing something brand new. In fact, Tom, you should come up here and take a victory lap. Tom Pools is here. He is the senior VP for digital e-commerce at Capital One, and they've implemented something that launched minutes ago, and it's pretty exciting. And it is a virtual number from your Eno assistant. I want to congratulate. Did it all launch as expected?
It did. It did. It's available now, and we think it's fantastic. We're all users of it prolifically ourselves.
I am too, because you gave me a little advance, and it's amazing. I'm going to describe it to people, but I'm glad. So it's up and running, and everybody with a Capital One card can get it now.
Everybody with a Capital One card can get it. Yeah.
And it's on. You can get a Chrome extension or a Firefox extension.
Chrome and Firefox, and if you're a fan of other browsers, more coming soon.
That's great. Tom Poole, thank you so much for doing this. And when you hear what this is, you're going to actually flip your lids because this is what you've been wanting all along. Imagine that when you go to a merchant and you're giving them your credit card number, I think this is something people legitimately worry about. It's happened to me more than once where I'll buy something from perhaps, you know, well, there was a Argentinian leather iPhone case maker.
Of course there was.
That shall remain nameless. They made beautiful cases. And the minute I gave them my credit card, all of a sudden all these other charges started appearing on my credit card. It's a little nerve-wracking to give your credit card out to strangers on the internet. So this is what Eno now does. Eno will generate a unique virtual number, virtual credit card number for each merchant that you visit. It uses a Chrome extension. It pops up. It's just like you're filling in your credit card number, but instead of filling in your real Capital One credit card number, you're filling in a number that's assigned to that merchant. It comes with a unique security code that's just for that number. It even comes with an expiration date that's 5 years in the future. So it's a five-year number that's tied to just that merchant. And from that point on, that merchant can continue to use it. You could use it for subscriptions. I use it at Amazon. That's the number that they use. It's charging my Capital One card, but if I lose that card, as you know, Stacy, I've showed my credit card number on camera more than once, and it is a really nasty moment because I know as soon as the show's over, I have to now not only cancel that number, but figure out what that number is attached to. And almost always, it's 20 or 30 different subscriptions and things. Not anymore. With the virtual number from Capital One, that number is still good. I'll get a new credit card number. It'll be reattached to the virtual number. I don't have to worry. I don't have to remember where it's attached. That's fantastic. A unique virtual number for everywhere you shop online. And you control those numbers. You can turn them on. You can turn them off if you want. So we talked to Tom earlier. Actually, we had a great conversation. He explained how Eno works to protect your credit card information.
In steps virtual numbers from Eno. Up pops a window that says, would you like to create a virtual number for checkout? It's only for that specific website.
For everywhere you shop online. And you can
simile of a credit card with the number on there. But we also fill in the new credit card number, the new three-digit security code, and the new expiration date, which is conveniently 5 years from today. And we fill that into the site automatically for you.
Virtual numbers map back to your physical card. Online merchants never see their actual number. And as always, if your card is lost or stolen, those numbers continue to work. Your payments hum along without interruption. Tom called it the reset moment.
And as we looked at this and realized that the most pressing problems our customers were facing was this giant reset moment, this whether the card expires or it's lost or stolen or it's compromised online, this moment when suddenly out of the blue you were being asked to spend a couple hours updating your numbers on every single site. It's terrible, and people live in fear of it, so much so that they actually steer their shopping toward a handful of sites that they trust and avoid trialing new experiences and new products precisely because they're afraid that it's a game of Russian roulette. If they put their number at one more site, that might be the site that triggers the event that is the real pain in the neck for everybody.
Just another way Capital One's intelligent assistant, Eno, is looking out for you. So shop smart, play smart with virtual numbers from Capital One. For more information, go to CapitalOne.com/Eno/virtual numbers. CapitalOne.com/Eno/virtual numbers. And we thank Capital One for inviting us to Austin, Texas, and South by Southwest, and to be the very first thing at the earliest possible moment.
I feel like there may have been yoga, sunrise yoga in the park somewhere.
There
I'm
was
just
meditation
saying.
Somewhere. I, knew, I know it.
It's
know
South
it.
By.
On the bleeding edge of South by Southwest.
So Stacy and Wendy are both from Austin. So this is normal for you. But where do you normally hang out?
I live in D.C.
D.C. So you're on East Coast time.
I'm on East Coast time.
So this is actually late in the day for you.
Oh, yeah. It's like I've already had dinner by this time.
So we're talking about, and actually it's really interesting because I had thought we were going to talk about what you really should be worried about, but this is the problem. It's very hard to know what you should really be worried about. Wendy, one of the things Duo does, which is great, is authentication is one of the big problems, right? This is kind of, in a way, a fundamental problem with credit cards, with everything. Web passwords proving you are you. And Duo, that's one of the things Duo does, right?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, I've used the Duo system, and it's fantastic because it's not texting you a number. But it's clear passwords are broken. Everybody has said this. This is one of the big issues with breaches, people remembering passwords, people use the same password over and over again. Is that something consumers should worry about?
You know, I don't think it should be the consumers that have to worry about it. I don't think it is their fault. You know, when we first came up with passwords, we thought we would use the freely available human memory as a cache for this authentication factor. And, it was widely available at the time, and it didn't cost anything. So we thought this was a good idea. Turns out not so much.
It's a scarce resource.
it is a very scarce resource, and it tends to degrade over time.
Yes.
And, at this point, I think we made a very bad mistake as technologists by telling people never write down your password.
Right.
You know, if you had written it down and put it in your wallet with your credit cards, it probably would have been just fine. But we scared people so much by saying, never write down your password, and it always has to be different. And I don't know who thought that asking humans to remember several hundred unique, very complicated character strings would ever work. And yet here we are, and that's where we are today.
That's a perfect example of how really, we got bad security advice that was well-intentioned.
It was at the time.
But it really isn't the right solution because it turned out that the threat model was different. I guess people assumed, the threat model is somebody's going to get your wallet and see your password, or you'll leave a post-it note on your computer, somebody's going to see your password. But that's not where this happens. It happens online. It happens in breaches.
Yeah. Right, yeah. Right.
Looking back through the history of the computer industry, if you go back to the 1970s and 1980s when we started having passwords, everybody had one.
Yeah.
Because you had one system that you connected to.
Yeah, you logged into your Lynx browser.
That's right. You logged into your Lynx browser to get on, the corporate mainframe
right. To
do the types of things you needed to do. As the industry and as technology has changed, evolved, grown, and increased over time, now we do have hundreds of systems that we log into routinely. And so the advice that we had in the 70s and 80s is now bad advice.
Right.
But we're kind of loath to retire it and to move on to something better.
We've seen, Google has FIDO too. We've seen other authentication proposals. Are they gaining any traction?
Absolutely. And if you think about password managers, which was, the kind of the first thing we thought of, let's put all these complicated strings in a database and then dole them out as we need them. We're sort of working our way towards building an interface between the user and the systems because we cannot we cannot ask them to keep doing this on their own anymore. It's just not fair.
So it's appropriate. I tell everybody to use a password manager. That's appropriate advice, yeah? Yeah.
Well, I will say I tell people the same thing, but they're like, what if it gets hacked? Which,
that's a good point.
In fairness, has happened. So yeah. I'm very curious, what in your ideal password scenario, which should encompass today's reality, what should we think about and what should we do?
That's a good question. I think that users are pushing back, and rightfully so, on the things that have gotten out of hand, and we are trying to build alternatives to this, especially to the password part. But I think we will end up having to go back to talking about what the real threat model is and how probable it is, because if you're a security professional, you see so many breaches all the time, you think they are happening all the time, just like a firefighter sees fires all the time and that's all they think about. But for a regular person who is not seeing this cluster of problems, they go through most of their lives without having to worry about this, and I think we should be realistic with them about how often it does
Couldn't
happen.
Agree more, yeah.
And I think So I used to work in a hospital, and one of the big issues that we had is if you put long, complicated passwords on things like medical devices, then the physicians can't get into them when they need to save a life, right? So what are we optimizing for?
Right. Yeah.
In general, the IT and IT security controls we have optimize for preserving the confidentiality of data. And as we're moving towards connected everything, the consequences are going to be different. The assets we're trying to protect are going to be different. So we have to come up with different, more robust schemes in that environment. In other words, when the impacts of cybersecurity are human life and public safety issues, we have to do something different. And let me give one quick example. If you could have a scenario where a physician walks up to an emergency room computer and it automatically knows that they're there and brings them into the last patient view that they had when they were in with the patient, I would say that that is both, it can be both more secure,
right,
more usable, and can speed time to get objective accomplished.
So that would be biometrics, face recognition, fingerprint.
It could be many things. Yeah. One of the things that I've been talking about for a little while, and nobody's built $1 billion business off of it, so if you do,
here's your opportunity.
Hey, we're in Austin, tons of innovation going on. But I call it meta multi-factor authentication, which is if I know a ton about you, then I know who you are. And it's authentication, but it's really identity, right?
Right.
Just like if I walk up to a security guard at my place of business, they might know me. They know me not just by my face, but also the way I walk, the way I talk to them.
The time of day, they see you.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah. We, as humans, do all of those things in processing, can I let this person in the door? Yet we are trying to train computers or train humans to act like computers instead of training computers to work with humans, as Wendy was saying earlier. So I think that one of the solutions is not to look at, how do we make passwords better? I think we pretty much all agree on this panel that that's not the solution. But how do we get past that and make more contextual interfaces within the computer systems that we use?
You know, the only problem I see with that is what if the doctor goes outside the hospital and gets hit by a bus? And then they carry the doctor back in, and all of a sudden they lay her down on a gurney right next to one of the devices, and suddenly it pops up. You know, it doesn't understand the context switch. The doctor's now a patient, and the identity itself is not enough. And especially as doctors tend to work for, you know, multiple healthcare providers, understanding that role is also really, really critical.
Yeah, it is. I mean, look, there's no silver bullet, but I think the model of the future needs to be more computers that act like humans and interface to our needs in our workflows rather than the other way around.
Well, I think you also hit the nail on the head, Bo, when you said multi-factor. So it's not just the face. It's a whole – in fact, Google's doing this. I know, with gait recognition, for instance, your Android phone, everybody has a unique gait. We've got super cookies that are able to figure out who you are based on a whole number of factors that are ultimately unique to you. There seems like this is a solvable problem, but it's going to take multi, not just face, not just, you know, gait, not just time of day, but a bunch of stuff that would be pretty reliable, pretty robust. Is anybody working on that?
Lots of people are.
I think so, in different ways, yeah.
Because authentication is a fundamental issue. It's not just logging into a website. It's everything you do, proving you are who you say you are, in every respect.
Well, and it's going to get even more complicated because we're not just people, but think about machines like cars, that sort of thing. So if you've got a fleet of trucks platooning off of each other, like self-driving trucks, can another truck join that platoon? Are they authenticated to be part of that? So I'm just throwing more stuff in. It's going to be more complicated, not just people.
But this is important, and this is kind of where we went wrong in the first place. And we didn't really blue sky what the scenarios were sufficiently to understand what the issues we were solving in security were. So we did the wrong thing. We did passwords, and we told people not to write them down. And so it's important, I think, at this point to think ahead. What are the scenarios? Can we do that effectively, reliably? Can we really look ahead and say, well, here's what hackers in the next 20 years are going to be looking for?
Well, we're working on that. So one thing, for example, that Duo's doing now is authenticating the user and the device that they're using together. So if I stole your password, I would also have to steal your phone.
That's
for the second
like
factor,
yeah.
And your device that you were using.
Right.
Because if I stole any you know combination of something else, even if it was approved by your employer, it still wouldn't work for me. So tying those factors more tightly together is something that we're doing today.
Yeah, that's why I used Duo with my LastPass, because it's a second factor that's really reliable to unlock my LastPass. But well, it's hard enough to get my mom to use LastPass, let alone a second factor authenticator. Actually, I told my mom, who's 85, just write it down. I did actually say, I went to the store. They sell books that say password on the front.
Yeah, yeah. Uh-huh.
And but you know, unless somebody breaks into her house, that's actually a fairly secure.
It is. It's very fair. And you know, I'm really tired of security professionals who go, "Oh my God, that's so horrible." No, you're not doing the threat modeling properly, and actually, you are defending very well against that hacker from Romania or whatever by just keeping it physically
right.
in your house.
Right. And it's she doesn't have to learn how to use LastPass. She doesn't have to. But, you know, get a second factor authenticator. I mean, it seems like a good solution for some people, not for everybody. It's
not for people who put it on their laptop and then they take pictures of their desk. Those people, they should think about that.
So that and voice is another thing. In fact, that's one thing. I don't think Amazon's doing it yet, but Google does that right now. And this worries me a little bit, that it will recognize my wife's voice when she asks for the calendar versus when I ask for it. But I don't know how reliable or...
Neither Google nor Amazon can recognize my voice. I'm
at all?
Constantly like, "Who am I?" And they're like, "I don't know, but you're on Stacey's account."
Really?
Yeah.
Congratulations, they say. You got in.
Yeah. I think that's one of the next kind of frontiers we have to first recognize and then tackle, which is that some of these things we treat as authentication issues are actually identity issues.
Yeah.
Okay, what's the difference?
So identity is who are you? Authentication is a challenge to verify that you...
have access to this account or
have access to the account,
yeah,
right? You know the things about the account to give you permission. But if
that's a big difference.
It is a big difference. If we separate those two ideas, if we look at identity, then we can say, okay, you are Stacy, and I know that you are Stacy. Therefore, you have access to Stacy's things. I could also then say, you know, you're Bo, and you don't have access. Or Stacy can say, I want to give Bo access to get into my house because he's staying with me as a house guest this week. So we can do those types of things, but if you have identity linked rather than authentication, then it becomes revocable, it becomes auditable. It gives us these techniques and these capabilities that we really need or want or will need in the future if we don't need them now, to be able to have a greater amount of trust in the technology that we're using.
I think we should just, you know, resurrect Babylon 5 and use the questions that they asked on the show, which is, who are you? Why are you here? You know, are you a doctor or are you a patient? Who do you serve and who do you trust? Because a lot of this is also about trust. We trust, after authenticating, we trust, you know, you to do a particular thing for the purpose of this device that you are using right now for this application, but not for a different one. And so all of those have to come in together.
And I think it's important, while we're talking about this, is all of these systems can and will be subverted. So nothing...
Well, that's encouraging.
Well, I'm just... But,
I feel
but,
better now.
Well...
No, but you're right. They will be. You're right.
The key is making... I mean, is understanding, again, the threat model. So, like, when you were talking about device authentication, I thought back to Mr. Robot and him stealing Gideon's little phone and to hack in. And I was like, oh, but... You have to understand.
Give you good ideas.
It did.
For
I'm
future.
Like, ooh.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You have to understand what you're protecting against and how far you need to go for a certain
right.
situation. So
that's one thing that's become clear in this conversation. It's not. You need to understand what the threats are and plan appropriately, which is easier than planning to protect yourself against every possible scenario.
Right. Yeah. If you look at systems broadly. All systems fail. All systems break down
right.
at some point. Physical systems are no different than digital systems, right? So you can have a bridge that collapses and crumbles over time, right? At the same time, we treat our computer systems in some ways as if they will never fail, or
eternal.
We hope they will never
yeah.
fail and
yeah.
try to make them never fail, rather yeah. than designing them to be resilient against failure, to anticipate and avoid some of the threats, to be able to contain and isolate some of the issues, so when
that's
some part of the system fails,
yeah.
it doesn't cascade. So if I hack your radio, for instance, I can't get into your brakes and shut them off.
Yeah.
To be able to update That's another principle that's really good if you're designing with failure in mind.
Right.
Taking help from others, like coordinated vulnerability disclosure programs, for instance. If a security researcher or, you know, heck, a doctor finds a flaw in a system, can they tell the manufacturer and get it fixed?
Without getting arrested.
Without getting arrested.
Yeah.
And
that's, by the way, that's a big problem these days.
It can
people
be.
Like Ed Felton at Princeton are really saying, I'm not sure I want to do the kinds of research I have been doing because it's increasingly looks illegal because companies don't want to be reverse engineered. That has to be okay.
Yeah, and there's a growing tension as well between when you buy something, do you own it or are you merely licensing it?
Now we're talking about John Deere, the right to repair.
John Deere, yep. Some of the right to repair stuff, but also some of the security research stuff. So people like Jay Radcliffe, who research medical devices, he might buy an insulin pump. Can he look for security flaws in the insulin pump that he bought?
Right. The legal structure is he doesn't own it. He's not allowed to reverse engineer it.
It depends.
Yeah.
So that's one of the fuzzy things.
Your point is it would be in the interest of the insulin pump manufacturer but they don't want to acknowledge that there are flaws. They want to act as if there are never flaws. Is it?
It's changing a lot. So actually, Jay did a coordinated vulnerability disclosure with Johnson & Johnson a few months back, in which Jay found a bunch of flaws in an insulin pump. He reported them to Johnson & Johnson. They got together and worked it out. And eventually, Johnson & Johnson acknowledged them, thanked him for it. They put out compatible press releases. And Jay said, you know what? This device is safe enough. I would have my kids use it
right.
if they needed to have an insulin.
This is a really great model for the future. And it requires end users, all of us, to understand that flaws are inevitable. It is not a sign of a bad product. In fact, it's a good thing when a product acknowledges these and fixes
Absolutely.
Them. And frankly, the press, the mainstream press, but also the tech press, need to also cover this in a responsible way, as opposed to the sensational headline, your pacemaker is hackable.
Well, a pacemaker is different because if it's not updatable, that's actually implanted in a human body performing a big function. That's not something that could, if you break it during your security update, that's a problem.
That would be a problem, wouldn't it?
Right.
Yeah.
So that's
yeah.
a little, like, there are some devices where I'm like, but external to the human body, sure.
Well, and what Bo just described really is a roadmap for IoT devices particularly, because we're putting all of these internet-connected devices throughout you mentioned cars, you mentioned medical devices, but Amazon Echoes and, you know, cameras. These are throughout our lives. They all provide potentially a gateway for an intruder into your internet systems.
And I never buy a connected device that isn't over-the-air updatable, that the companies have some sort of security reporting program.
Yeah.
Those are, like, two huge things I look for. I look for some other stuff. But for a normal person, I would totally
really
recommend
good advice. That. Yeah. Has to be firmware updatable. And the company has to have
over-the-air updatable.
Over-the-air.
So, like, because
you don't want to plug in every device.
You hand me a USB stick and tell me to plug that into my car. I'm like, no, that's not happening.
Over-the-air updatable. And do companies frequently state their policy in regards to this? I mean, that would be
As a journalist, I ask.
Yeah.
So, and then I usually try to put it in my
Tell
article.
People.
I'm like, hey. And that's another thing. I would say the media needs to, both companies should start paying attention to their security efforts, educating people about their security efforts so it becomes something you look for. And then also the media, we should be asking and saying, hey, by the way, I noticed that these guys, they use a slightly lower grade AES encryption, but I don't care because it's just traffic about my light bulbs going on and off in my house. So that's okay, y'all.
Yeah, there's a big push for, in the U.S. as well as in Europe, for labeling for security of IoT devices, and there was a project that the National Telecommunications Information Agency Administration did last year that I helped with, along with Microsoft was there, Rapid7 was there, a lot of other companies were there, and we built out some frameworks for disclosing to your customers your policy on supporting security updates throughout the device's lifecycle. What we came to is, you know, essentially tell your customers, is it updatable? Roughly how? Over the air versus you have to use a USB stick. And then for how long, which is critically important, that lifetime and life cycle, because
That's
at some
big.
Point
yeah.
you're going to stop getting updates for it.
Yeah.
You have to know when so that you can either discard the device or pick up the maintenance aspects of it yourself in yeah. some form or fashion.
We've seen this a lot, with, especially with low-cost IoT devices. None of those things, but particularly this end-of-life thing is,
yeah.
is a huge issue because they just don't get supported. They don't. Nobody's...
I demand, y'all, an expiration date on my devices.
That's
no
really
one's doing
good.
This. And I ask all the time, and they're like, eh, maybe we'll support it for 5 years. But when I'm buying a thermostat, and let's say they plan to support it for 3 years, I'm not going to put that thermostat in my house. Because
right. Its useful life is much more than 3 years, but not if you don't do updates.
Right.
If you're tweeting right now, that would be a great quote to tweet out for this.
Yeah, that is great.
And actually, so in France, they just published a strategy for Internet of Things security. And I haven't seen a good English translation yet, but roughly one of the lines is, when a device is no longer supported, you have to open source the software.
Oh, I love that.
That's fascinating. And I think that exposes a fundamental conflict that we have between things that were built to last, which was everything, you know, just about in existence up until this point, as opposed to replace and update early and often. And you see this conflict with things like, 10 or 20-year MRI machines yep. that can only take so many functional updates.
They're still
never
running Windows XP,
ones.
And that's it. Yeah. You know, it's yeah. not going to change.
Because XP was a perfectly good operating system.
Yeah, right.
It was built to last. It is performing its function. But it is a conflict between the assumption we have made with a lot of other electronic things where you're going to be updating all the time at the speed of light. So we really have to reconcile those two manufacturing things that are now coming together.
Yeah, I'd say we've got a lot of problems that we have good solutions for. We're just not applying in security. And then we've got problems we don't yet have good solutions for, where there's still a lot of pain to try and do things like updates on Internet of Things devices. And right now there's a mismatch, as Wendy alluded to. You might have something that's meant to live in the field 10, 20, 30, 40 years. Well, an operating system is generally meant to live, in Windows, maybe 10 years, Android 2. So in a lot of cases, by the time you get done with the development cycle of the device, the operating system is already deprecated. That's a real fundamental challenge that we have to come to grips with, and that's one area where I think we do need a lot more research, and we need to work a lot harder to reduce the pain of those updates so that we can get into tighter, faster update cycles.
There's a big collision coming because smartphones, we're seeing people are buying refurbished, they're keeping them longer. Yep. This notion that you would only have it for 2 years is clearly not being reflected in the current marketplace, and yet these operating systems are not getting updated, and the vast majority of Android phones, for instance, will never be patched. They'll never have security patches on them.
Yeah, I'd say there's at least a couple of different types or archetypes of buyers, and you described one really well, which is the types of people who just want
the normal person.
The normal person, right? But you also have a high security conscious person.
And I never keep a phone more than 6 months. I'm not worried.
Right.
Yeah, that's security's
right.
why.
Yeah, for security reasons. That's it. Yeah. What are companies' attitudes towards this, though? Because this is challenging for them. I mean, this in every respect, this is something they seem like they don't want to do.
Well, there's two types of companies, too, right? There's the manufacturers, and then there's the buyers. So a lot of commercial IoT devices are actually being bought by companies rather than by individuals. I mean, if you look around the facility that we're in, you'll probably find 10 to 20 connected devices. I see a camera over there. Mm-hmm. I see televisions around.
You only see one, really?
Well, but the point is there's companies on the buying and on the receiving and the
right. They have more clout than individuals.
Right. And so there can be mechanisms that each side kind of agrees to. You know, in some cases, companies manufacture and buy things. Right. Manufacturers have a supply chain just like retail outlets have a supply chain. So, you know, how do you propagate some of these better practices throughout the entire supply chain? And that's some of the research that is being worked on right now. And there's some legislation pending. There's some technical things that we're trying to do to help that happen. But
the EU seems a little bit ahead of us in some of this stuff. You mentioned France.
Yeah.
Can we rely on the EU to kind of push everybody forward, or is it not going to affect us in the U.S.? What are you laughing at, Stacey?
America first comes to mind.
Yeah.
You won't be led by Europeans.
different but countries have
it's
different...
It's a global market now, though.
Yeah, it is.
We're going to have a bit tariff soon, just you wait.
So it's a global market. It's a global supply chain. We have global adversaries. All of these things are becoming more globalized.
Yeah.
And as different countries and regions of the world have different paces of change and different paces of regulation, you know, in some spaces, it looks like China might actually get out ahead of the United States or Europe. In other places, Europe is leading, particularly around privacy and the general data protection requirement, GDPR, that came out a couple last year and is going into
But it goes into effect in May, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then some of the things that are happening in U.S. legislation around particularly and regulation, not just legislation, around the cyber safety system. So different countries and different regions of the world are accelerating at different rates. That's hard often for businesses to keep track of. So really, if we kind of come together and have a more harmonized approach, but still a fast approach, then I think we can get there sooner.
I think in a way that's kind of what I was thinking of as the point of this panel was to assess what the real threats are and to act appropriately, both as individuals and as a community. Because if we can do that, I think a lot of this can be fixed. But the problem is there's so much fear and scare and sensationalism going on. A lot of people just kind of throw up their hands. People like me just say, I don't care. I'm just going to install everything everywhere and worry about it later. I think that's probably the most – there's two ways of doing this. Like Wendy, who will have none of this, no voice assistants in my house. And me, I have voice assistants stacked.
You have a voice assistant with a camera, I think, by your bed.
Really?
No, Lisa doesn't let that happen.
There's an old Jeff Foxworthy joke. If you have a TV on top of a non-working TV, you might be a redneck. And
what if you have an Amazon Echo on top of a Google Home on top of it?
You might be a twit.
I'm a twit.
I do have an internet connected mug though.
Do you have the Ember mug?
Yeah, actually, my husband ordered it, and yeah, it's very weird to have him say, "Hang on, I got to update my mug."
Yeah.
At some point, you know, it's going to be too much.
Stop
you know,
the insanity.
And the other problem is that making something easy to update can also make it vulnerable.
That's true.
Because one person's update is another person's hack.
That's
so
true.
We're still not out of the woods yet, but I think especially manufacturers who are just venturing into this or with shoes. I saw a Kickstarter
for internet connected shoes
where you can...
Is that the Pizza Hut?
No, it's another one where you can download and your own patterns to display on the shoes. And these are clearly for teenagers. And my first thought was dress code violation at school because I would totally hack my friend and put something really inappropriate
nasty
on their shoes. Or I could put notes for the test, you know.
Oh.
You know, check out my shoes while I'm taking an exam. And then they wanted to create a marketplace to sell designs, buy and sell designs. And I thought, because putting money into an internet-connected marketplace always makes it more secure.
Uh-huh.
That's right.
And so, you know, there's a slippery slope for just about everything you can think
of. Yeah, if my shoes have been hacked, it probably isn't going to be the end of my world, right?
I don't know. If you get suspended from school,
well, maybe,
and you're a kid.
Think about if you make a fashion faux pas. If somebody causes you to make a fashion
faux pas. My life is over.
Paisley. Paisley, really? Yeah.
This is so fun. I'm so glad that the three of you are here. Of course, Stacey Higginbotham from This Week in Google, Stacey on IoT.com. Wendy Nather, who is the Director and Advisory Chief Information Security Officer, CISO, right? CISO, we're going to call it at Duo Security. And Bo Woods from the Scowcroft Center for Strategy and Security. We'll have more in just a bit. Thank you all for coming. A nice audience here. It's great to see you all. I hope you're enjoying the taco deli and the breakfast tacos, Austin's favorite. I saw some queso over there. But I knew that if I started, it would be all awesome. I'm going to wait till after the panel.
There is no after. An hour and a half of queso, you just have a lump of cheese.
Oh, yeah, it's not edible.
That's right.
Dang it.
That was just in queso emergency.
Oh!
There we got it. We got the groans. Yes. Yeah. Yes.
And I want to really thank the folks at Capital One for inviting us down to Austin for this event at the Capital One House at South by Southwest. We're at Antone's. If you're watching live, you want to come over. I think there's a few minutes left. Please hurry on over. Capital One is our sponsor for the show as well. They have announced something I think is really fantastic. Credit cards are if you're talking security, something that absolutely concerns people, especially if you're using a credit card online. But I have to say now with my Capital One card, using my credit card online, I actually look forward to it because I've got the new Eno virtual numbers Chrome extension. There's one for Firefox. Other browsers are coming soon. That does something so great. I'll give you the scenario. You're ready to buy that small batch organic fair trade coffee beans. I don't
queso.
Know why I'm thinking about coffee.
Queso.
Yes, from the Austin queso roaster or whatever they call it.
The queso melter.
The queso melter. The cheese smelter. And you're getting cold feet. You're at the checkout page. You're looking at it, but you don't know. I don't know. Is this the best? Is this the best Austin can offer? Maybe you're afraid your credit card number might fall into the hands of some phony queso maker. That wouldn't be good. Or hackers. That would be even worse. Well, with Eno from Capital One, you get virtual numbers to serve up to your online retailers so that your actual credit card number is not exposed. And unlike queso, these virtual numbers are good for 5 years. 5 years. So you can continue to use them. Even if you lose your credit card, you get a new credit card and a new credit card number, but those numbers are still good. But at any time, if you say, you know, this queso ain't the best queso, you can have the number canceled. Tom Poole, who is the Senior Vice President for Digital E-Commerce at Capital One, we talked to him earlier and we asked him, how can you get and use Eno? Listen.
That works for basically for every Capital One card. It's as simple as downloading and installing the browser extension. Right now it's for Chrome. Firefox is coming quickly, and then Safari. Our plan is to cover every single browser. We make it available to all Capital One credit card holders, soon debit.
If you have an existing Capital One credit card, just download and install the browser extension. It's in the Chrome Web Store, the Firefox extension. What do they call it? A store? What does Firefox call it? I don't even know. But you know where to go. And soon your browser near you. So go ahead, buy that queso. Dip away. Feel no fear. Enjoy the queso buzz. Capital One's intelligent is, you don't, it's not just for queso. I just want to be clear. Don't think you can only buy queso with this. Eno has your over quesoed back. For more information, visit CapitalOne.com. I think we've stretched this a little too far. CapitalOne.com/Eno.
Yeah, it's getting cheesy.
Okay, Wendy gets the pun award of the week. CapitalOne.com/Eno/virtual numbers to find out more. CapitalOne.com/Eno/virtual numbers. We're actually glad to be here for the debut of Eno's virtual numbers. It just launched minutes ago, and now you can get them. I've been using them for a while, and it's really awesome. Wendy and Bo and Stacy, it's really nice to have you here today. We're talking, I think this, I've already learned quite a bit about real and imagined threats. We were at our meetup yesterday. I was talking to John, and he had his keys, and I said, boy, those look like mine, because he's got a lot of stuff, and he's got two fobs for keyless entry to his car. I said, yeah, I don't know why this is so big. And it's because it's got a transmitter in it. But so you can walk up to the car and just get in, which is a huge, turns out, security risk. I had to explain to him how that thieves can easily, go to eBay, buy a $30 transmitter and get into his car. Is that a real threat? You talk about this, right?
Yeah, that's, so I would say it is a real threat. And also, it's one that not everyone has to worry about, right? So there's a radius for things like key fobs within which the radio frequency will work.
Right.
And if an adversary is outside that radius, they can't clone your key and get into your car, right? So there's a physical proximity.
But it's farther than you might think.
On the flip side, your car is also connected to the internet, so somebody on the other side of the planet can get into your car directly. Right?
Well, what would they do? Now, I know the thief who's there will take my cassettes.
Yes.
You
got rid of the 8-track player last year.
Yeah. I'm very, that's good. But those Boston cassettes, they're valuable. So that's one thing. But what can a thief across the world do?
So some of the security researchers in our field have demonstrated that remotely over the air, they can actually get into a car infotainment system. And once you're into the infotainment
system. And make me listen to Engelbert Humperdinck.
They can make you listen to Engelbert Humperdinck, which is not the worst thing that could happen.
No, actually.
It turns out that a lot of the infotainment systems in a lot of the cars are actually connected on what's called a CAN bus. You can think about it as like a car area network, which is what it stands for. And so if they get into your infotainment system, they can control your steering, they can control your brakes, they can shut off your engine.
We've seen, they showed it on, we had the guys, who did this
Charlie Miller.
Minutes. Yeah, we had Charlie Miller on, and he showed how easy that is to do. That's terrifying.
It's not, okay, it was hard for him to get in there, and I mean, it took him some time to figure out the hack, but once he figured it out, it's actually fairly easy to execute.
You have to be a particularly malicious person to do this, though. I mean, there's no benefit to you. It's just mean.
Well, Dan Gere says on the internet, every sociopath is your next-door neighbor.
Oh, God.
The internet's essentially a frictionless environment.
Not helping,
right?
Bo. Not helping. You and Dan.
No, it's true, though. And even if it's 0.1%
that's right.
of the world, they have ability.
And if you think about it, people have said, well, no one's ever going to hack your car to kill you. That just is unreasonable.
Right.
If they wanted to do that, they'd just cut your brake lines.
That's true.
And that's true. But also, there's criminal groups who might want to ransom your car so you can't drive it until you pay them a Bitcoin. There's ideological adversaries that we know want to do us harm.
Right.
That if they had the knowledge that this is possible and the capabilities to do that, they would absolutely take advantage of it. So it's not enough to say, well, no one would. We want to say no one could.
Yeah. When Kevin Roos wrote that great piece in Fusion, which he invited two hackers to hack him, and they did, he had asked a number of security experts, and one of them said something I thought was really good. He said, well, you walk down the street every day, but if a group of ninjas decided to attack you, there really wouldn't be much you could do. You could learn some sword techniques, I guess. But the point is, people are generally able to walk down the street safely. So that's really my question is, how much should we worry about? These are all theoretical attacks, and we certainly have seen adversaries do all sorts of bad things, but to any given individual, how risky is the world out there?
Or maybe how do you assess the risk?
Your risk.
Your
personal risk, yeah.
We often hear that, particularly in safety spaces, healthcare, automotive, that no one's ever hacked a car to kill someone, or no one's ever hacked a medical device to kill someone.
Yeah.
But in reality, we lack the evidence capture mechanism
we don't know.
To be able to say, right?
Yeah.
So we can theorize, and there have been theories about people who have been killed in various scenarios in cars and medical devices. But what worries me more than someone who's targeting you is the indiscriminate act. So last May and last June, two really destructive pieces of malicious software spread around the internet like fire, right? That's WannaCry and NotPetya. And WannaCry in particular, we've just learned in the past couple of months, took offline something like 30% of UK healthcare providers for somewhere between a day and a couple of weeks. And if you think about what that does to the ability to provide care, I have no doubt in my mind that people died accidentally as a cause or as the result of that, right? So I think we're at a tipping point right now where we have no high profile smoking gun cases to date. But in the future, we will have some.
Right.
When we do, what is that going to do to public confidence in these systems? Will that make us retreat to things that are less safe, that have less promise and less capability? Will that delay autonomous vehicles, which have the potential to save something like 30,000 lives a year, will that delay them for another decade? What's the cost of the inability to trust the Internet of Things?
Yeah, and I think that to put this in a more optimistic light, it's really good that we have a lot of smart people who are thinking about this and working on demonstrating these problems so that they get fixed before they become so commonplace that it affects regular people. Karen Elizari describes hackers as the internet's immune system, finding invaders and dealing with them.
Yeah.
And she has a great TED talk on that.
Yeah.
So, because we do have so many researchers who are thinking about this first, I think we're in better shape than if we got to the point where we had smoking guns everywhere and people finally said, okay, maybe we should do something about it.
Yeah. You said an interesting thing, though, Bo, the idea that we might step back to something that's actually less safe.
Right.
And then there's also weighing the benefit of an autonomous vehicle, which will save thousands of lives in motor vehicle accidents, but open up the door to maybe some other few lives, probably, being lost due to hacking. D- Do we need to make that judgment? This is worth it?
Yeah, this I'll save
That's
the longer
scary.
Version of this, but if you look at the way that we've looked at security broadly for the past few thousand years, it's been primarily around physical safety. It's mm-hmm. been primarily around, if you're within, stabbing distance of someone, that's what you care about.
Ninjas,
that's mm-hmm. right. And by and large, we're moving to a situation where you don't have that physical barrier. Somebody doesn't have to be right next to you. And so we're moving from more of a, what you might call an actuarial level threat. Threats manifest over time at a fairly steady rate. They have rises and dips, but you have time to respond to them at a societal level. And with everything being plugged in and connected to the internet and everything relying on the same sets of software, we're moving towards something more like an epidemiological threat landscape. Something like public health, where you have zero or virtually zero incidents, and then you have a patient zero, and the entire rest of the vulnerable and exposed population is impacted at the speed of the network.
Right.
Right. And that's an epidemiological phenomenon. So I think the trade-offs are worth making in a lot of cases. In some cases, they may not be. But one of the things that we need to do, kind of to Wendy's point, is where we know how to improve security, we need to do it there. And where we have problems today and we can't do it really well, we need to get better so that it would actually take ninjas, not your next-door neighbor's kid.
Right. I have to give credit to Amy Webb, who came up with this idea. She's the author of The Signals Are Talking. She's a regular on one of our shows. She said, we need a CDC for internet security or for security. We need the CDC does such a good job protecting us from health threats. We need an agency like that to protect us from security threats. Do you agree? You think that's a good idea?
Well, I think to some extent we already have this with CERT and with the intelligence sharing and analysis centers that have sprung up in a lot of areas, both regionally and on an industry basis. So I think we're really getting there. I think the problem is that when you start centralizing this too much, it slows down the reaction time. So, for example, I took part in the Department of Homeland Security's Cyberstorm 5 exercise, in which we brought together a bunch of different industry verticals and government and so on to do a tabletop exercise. And interestingly enough, the scenario that we practiced turned out to be very, very similar to the WannaCry.
Was this before WannaCry?
This was before WannaCry, but it played on the tendency of organizations, whenever they get some intelligence, especially in the form of an IP address, to just block it reflexively. And in this case, in the scenario, it actually would cause the machine to be bricked if you blocked it. And that turned out to be the same thing with WannaCry, where the researcher discovered that this domain that it was calling out to wasn't registered, and he registered it, and that acted as a kill switch. He didn't know it at the time. But what happened was that we went through this exercise, and it was figured out pretty quickly. It turned out by some PayPal folks. They have some very smart security folks there. But then the answer to how do we get this out to everybody else so that they can defend themselves, and how do we do it in a way so that the adversary doesn't notice us getting this information out to those who are not part of the CERT or are not part of the
IFAC. So this process is happening, though. That's good. That's encouraging.
Yeah, we're testing it, but the thing is we stopped the exercise before we got to what to me was the most interesting part. How do we do this on a global scale or even a national scale, and how do we do it in a way without tipping off the adversary?
You mentioned Marcus Hutchins, who figured out the kill switch. You've I think, written a little bit about him. Am I wrong, Bo?
I haven't written too much.
Is he still under house arrest? What's his current status?
Actually, there was a great article just the other day in New York Magazine, I think it was, that did a profile on him.
He's and a really interesting example of, and I think of how we deal with people like Marcus, who has maybe a shady past, but also is very important to current security research. Go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt. No,
that's exactly a tension that I think is worth bringing up and discussing, right? There are a lot of the things that you need to know as a security researcher that can sometimes blur the lines.
They're often gray or even black hat in history, you know, in their past.
Yeah. So if I try and find security flaws in my own medical device, like Jay Radcliffe did, does that make me a criminal?
Right.
On the other hand, if I write malicious code that someone else uses to extort people, does that make me a criminal? Well, what if I didn't know that person was using it? What if I wrote it and I knew that they might use it, but I didn't pull the trigger?
This is what Hutchins is being accused of.
Yeah, you cross over and over that line. It's like the Pantone goalposts get moved. And, you know, either you're white, no, you're gray, no, you're black.
Right.
You know.
And it's really tough. So, you know, I think...
That's one you could tweet to, the Pantone goalposts are moving.
I like that one. There's a lot of this that we still haven't gotten figured out, right? And in talking to some of the people involved in the criminal justice system, they say, where is this line? You know,
the DOJ was getting some maybe reasonable criticism for going after Marcus, because does that cast a shadow against other researchers? Are people, for instance, I know a lot of researchers are reluctant to come to the U.S. They're afraid of getting picked up as Marcus was on their way out of town.
Well, I think I don't know any inside details about the case.
Nor do I, should say. Yeah.
Right. One of the things that, just looking at this more broadly, when you do have to pull in somebody who's gone over the line, how do you do it?
Right.
How do you message it? How do you work with them? And I think that's what I would like to see more discussion between law enforcement community, Department of Justice, and the security research community, because in the hacker community, we have rules of engagement, we have bounds, we have... essentially a self-regulating community, which there's a little bit of research out there on that. How do self-researching regulatory communities police each other and themselves?
Oh, it's like a guild. Like there used to be thieves guilds and that sort of thing. Yeah. Maybe that's just
assassins guilds. Yeah.
Yeah, that feels a little
different. There is a guild. Actually, in the guild hall in London, they do have the Worshipful Company of Information Technologists. There is a guild.
And what do they worship?
Presumably, they worship the queen. I imagine.
So, but that is an important point. Is that another way to address this? Is I don't want to say peer pressure, but a sense of community among hackers and among even black hat hackers, that there are some things that cross the line, some things that don't cross the line, and that can actually be very effective, can't it? In keeping people because people care about what other people think about them, even the most sociopathic actors.
And a lot of this used to be done for money. So it's one thing to steal money from an unknown faceless entity. It is another thing to cause the death of a person. So I can see people who are like, money,
But don't cross that line.
So, and also the skills to be, the mindset to be a hacker. I mean, I'm listening to Wendy talk about how she would subvert everything, and I'm like, oh, dear God, nothing is safe. But... I also want to like
shoes are not safe.
Wendy, how do I hack it? You know, and just give her random stuff, and she's like, "Oh, here's how I'd go around that."
Yeah,
but that's a lot. That's really threatening to governments and people. So,
and yet I am very sympathetic to people who have that. That's fun.
Yeah,
right. I can understand that. And more importantly, we need people who are with that mindset, because that's how you figure out if something is safe or not. That's how you figure out how to make stuff safe. You have to be thinking that way.
I've done a little bit of work with Naval Postgraduate School out in Monterey, California, and they train special operations forces, and particularly in counterproliferation.
Yeah.
So when you're going into a foreign country, you have to track down a village where there might be some nuclear, chemical, biological weapons being developed. Oftentimes what they find today is that when they go into those communities, somebody might have picked up some suspicious equipment, but they're using it to synthesize insulin to treat the diabetics in the village rather than to create a bioweapon. So oftentimes engaging in those communities in more of an open manner.
And directing them in a positive fashion.
That's right. You absolutely unlock them as a capability.
Which is great.
Rather than an inhibitor.
Yeah.
And what they've found, and they're trying to apply it in the U.S., in some of the law enforcement capabilities, and the FBI has done a pretty good job last few years, from what I've heard with biohacking communities, is if you go in with kind of an open mind and being willing to engage with people in a more positive, proactive manner, then all of a sudden they will help you find the bad actors and get them out.
Right.
If you go in and shut things down,
right,
then the community falls back and defends itself and protects the bad actors with the good.
And sometimes it's an economic issue. Maybe I'm simplistic, but I often get the sense that, you know, we see so much hacking coming out of Central Europe and the fallen Soviet states because you have sophisticated, highly trained people who can't make a living. And we often see that many of these ransomware payoffs are in the thousands of dollars. These people aren't becoming millionaires on this. They're barely making it, but that's sufficient for them because there's no other opportunity. Is that simplistic or is that an accurate?
That's absolutely accurate. I mean, I work with some folks in the Ukraine. In Ukraine.
And I always say the Ukraine too. I know.
Yeah, it's old a habit. Whole show on propaganda that we shouldn't get into right now. But I work with some folks in Ukraine, and they're really highly skilled. They've got a couple of degrees. Same is true with Romania, and yet they can't find work locally.
Right.
So luckily, kind of the gig economy has come along.
Right.
And in Romania, they've gone from a safe haven for criminals to something like 5% of their economy is based on IT services to Europe and the United States. So they've flipped that switch. They've employed those highly trained, highly capable individuals.
Right.
But I tend to look at it like if you go and talk to the coca growers in Colombia and ask them what their moral choice is, you know, to put shoes on their kids' feet and send them to school or to grow a crop that doesn't pay any money. Well, there's an obvious moral choice there.
Right. I don't want to act as if it's the bad guys are all the hackers, because there's some burden on companies too. And I think of Equifax because they had a lot of data about a lot of us, which somehow got exfiltrated from Equifax. What is the responsibility of these companies who are holding our data? Admittedly, they're being hacked. It's bad guys that are hacking them, but maybe they aren't doing the best job of protecting us either.
Well, that's a really much more of a complicated question than it sounds like, because I don't believe that we know what companies really need to do to achieve effective security. I don't think anybody can give you a list and say, if you do this, you will be secure, and this is how much it's going to cost. So that's one problem. The other thing is that a lot of companies, and we as human beings, tend to follow a model that I called cheeseburger risk management, which is where you're going to keep eating cheeseburgers until your first heart attack, and then you're going to stop. but for security,
Sony Pictures Entertainment followed that plan. They spent as little as they could to secure their stuff until they got hacked.
Well, and who's to say that's not a viable business model? Because if it costs you $1 million a year to run a security program, and in your second year you get hacked and it only cost you $500,000, you came out ahead from a business perspective.
Right.
And we all, you know, approach risk that way. We are not going to defend against ninjas until the first ninja attack, because, you know, this is the problem, especially for small and medium-sized businesses. We don't know if they can afford the security that they need. So it's much more complicated than it sounds.
And I think part of that is a failure of our industry, our community, the information security community. Giving bad advice, conflicting advice, as well as some of the manufacturers not building some of these things in and making it easy to do.
Yeah.
Over the next 5 years or so, we'll spend around $1 trillion globally on people, products, and services in information security. Yet we'll still have, over that same timeline, about 100% failure rate. About 100% of the organizations will be breached. And maybe that's the right trade-off to make. I don't know. That seems like the wrong one. But looking at it from that perspective, and then
you can't expect companies to do anything more than it's similar to the Ukrainian hacker do anything more than or the coca raising guy. You can't expect them to do anything more than what's economically sensible for them, right? I mean, they're going to act as economic entities and do the rational thing from an economic point of view. But as a consumer, if Equifax has my data and doesn't protect it, you know, regardless of their economic sense of
also,
rationale.
Also, in that example, none of us actually agreed to our data getting aggregated in that way.
Well, we kind of did, because when that's part of it's in the fine print. You agree. You have to have, I mean, this is difficult. You have to have consumer credit reporting or you can't do a lot of the activities that we do in modern society. So I think these companies have to exist, but I think they also have a higher responsibility. And there's also the question of whether it's possible even to be fully secure. When you look at somebody like Shelley Adelson, who had unlimited funds to protect the SANS back end for casinos. And you would think anybody who is running a back end for casinos has to have the top computer security that's out there. And he still got hacked. They still got hacked by, I think we could think it's by Iranians or Iraqis. I can't remember.
Iranians.
So if something, the back end of the casino operations in Vegas can be hacked, who is safe? Right? Is that, or is that?
Well, there's different classes of adversaries. So you mentioned
a governmental adversary.
You know, nation states have the capability level like no other.
Could you even have an effective security plan against a nation state attacker?
Depends on how you define effective. So you might never be able to keep a nation state out because, look, at the end of the day, they could just co-opt one of the security people who already works there.
They have infinite resources.
That's right. But what you can do is you can look at the kind of capability level of adversaries and say, okay, here's where we want to draw the line.
Right.
So if a nation state level adversary wants to get us, they will be able to do it at a certain point, right?
Right.
But below that, we should at least be able to stop the script kiddies who just download something off the internet and click go. We should at least be able to stop some of the freely available tools. We should at least be able to stop some of the low-hanging fruit criminals who trade on the criminal underground. And I think that, to Wendy's point, actually there's a lot of things that we're not doing, not applying, that we know how to do. There's a lot of things that we need some help to get better at, right? But we, by and large, where we don't have a checklist, we can't all agree to that, we at least know the ways in which we can fail, and we can avoid the ways that we fail, and we can replicate the ways that we haven't found that fail yet.
Right.
What I think we lack, by and large, is awareness of those, and that's a resource pipeline problem. We also lack incentives to do so, political and institutional will. We lack widespread distribution of some of the capabilities, which, again, goes back to the pipeline problem. So there are some things that we could do at the national level, at the industry level, and at other levels to actually spur action towards a more secure posture, which doesn't have to cost billions or trillions of dollars. It can be, you know, some of the just simple things that keep those low-hanging fruit adversaries out.
And if you get hacked by a nation state, I would say every device, every institution should have some sort of account, like auditability. I don't know. You have to know that you've been hacked. So even if you know like in my house, I know that someone, if they wanted to, could break in a window or jamming my door open. But I have a next layer of defense that at least says, hey, by the way, someone's in your house.
Right.
In the physical world, we call that like tamper evidence. So if you get a box from Amazon and the tape's been ripped off, you know somebody got into it, right? If you have your door that's been kicked in and splintered, you know somebody got in. In a lot of these places, we lack the evidence capture, the tamper evidence facility. And also, there's not a lot of people looking at that. And when they do, they're lost in a mountain of data. So that's one of the problems I think we need to get a better grip on, to be able to address and design an operation.
Isn't that, I mean, as a CISO, Chief Information Security Officer, isn't that what you do? Are there best practices?
Well, I hate calling them best practices because a best practice would be to, you know, cover a computer in cement and sink it to the bottom of a pool. That would be the, you know, absolute best. So you're always doing trade-offs based on the business needs of your company. And, you know, in the case of public safety and health and so on, sometimes safety trumps security.
Yeah.
You know, and it should be that way. We want it to be that way. So there's always that negotiation depending on where you are working, what business it is, what your priorities are. You know, how much budget you have. I mean, when I started at one job, I was the only security person there, and I had a budget literally of zero when I walked in.
And good luck.
And you know,
best wishes.
Exactly. When I walked in and they said, you know, what do you want, you know, what is your budget request? And I put down $2,000 because I wanted to get like a logging server and a couple of books. And the person I was working for, and this was in the public sector, scribbled it out and said, where do you think you are, the private sector?
Oh, Lord.
So we still haven't figured out what is really necessary and made sure that businesses get what they need, both in terms of expertise and influence in money and capabilities to be able to achieve that level. Even if we're pretty sure we know it when we see it, you know, the closest that we have is compliance. So that's what we're doing. Most people say compliance does not equal security, but it's a pretty good start.
And you're talking about governmental requirements?
Yeah, like regulations, HIPAA, whether it's PCI DSS right. or whether it's HIPAA or FERPA or whatever. Right. You know, for those particular risk cases, we are starting to come up with lists of things that we think you should be doing. But some of this is going to be, you know, fought on other battlefields and figured out, you know, in policy because right. we don't know yet.
Right. Wendy Nather, it's so good to have you from Duo Security. Bo Woods from the Scowcroft Center for Strategy and Security from Stacy on IoT, Stacy Higginbotham. We're going to take one last break, and I know this is maybe a little more personal, but I'd like to know what each of you do in your own life to protect yourselves that you would recommend or what you tell family and friends to do, and we'll wrap up with that. I'm going to give you a time to think about that while I tell you what I have done, which is get a Capital One card and set up my Eno virtual numbers, which is really awesome. Capital One launched this morning, and we're here to kind of celebrate this at Capital One House at South by Southwest. Now that the internet is giving you access to products all over the world of any kind, I mean, that's a wonderful thing, but I think it does raise the issue of how you're paying and the security that your credit card has. And I think that it's fantastic that they've created these virtual numbers from Capital One. It solves a lot of problems. First of all, get the virtual number plug-in. First, you get a Capital One card. Then get the virtual number plug-in for your Chrome or Firefox browser, other browsers to come. And when you go to a site where you want to use a credit card, you have the option very easily, just as you would, you know, automatically fill in the browser, fill in your credit card information, to have that Eno plug-in fill in unique credit card number, a unique security number, and an expiration date 5 years from today. And that is designed to work specifically with that merchant, no other. You completely control it. You can revoke it at any time. And while it's attached to your credit card number, if you should misplace or lose your credit card number or get it stolen or just lose control of it, you can get a new credit card, but those virtual numbers continue to work as long as you want them to work. And that saves me a real hassle because I know I'll probably show my credit card number one more time on the show. I've done it, I think, 3 times now, and it's a pain every time. But there are other ways you can lose control. Virtual numbers from Capital One. Keep your real credit card number to yourself or just close friends watching you on the stream. Virtual numbers back to your physical card, which means online merchants never see the actual card number. That means your privacy is protected too, which I think is fantastic. And as I said, if your card is lost or stolen, those virtual numbers keep working to ensure your online subscriptions or recurring payments keep humming along without interruption. If you already have a Capital One card, great news. You're ready to go. Just go to www.capitalone.com/Eno/virtual numbers. I'm sure you'll see when probably he'll text you, right? Say, hey, get that virtual number, right? I love, by the way, I have conversations with Eno. Maybe I'm a little lonely, I don't know. But I really like Eno texting me what's going on with my credit card. You know, one thing Eno does that's really cool, if you leave a restaurant, I'm a big tipper, but if you leave a restaurant and you leave a tip that's over 30%, Eno will just say, you know, maybe you meant to do this, maybe you got really great service, but just so you know, there was a really big tip on that. And that way, if the server is just like adding a little to the, it's little things like that I love. Capital One has got it down. CapitalOne.com/Eno/virtual numbers if you want to know more. We're really thrilled to be here. We thank Capital One for doing a great product, but also for bringing us here to Austin for South by Southwest and for letting me bring together such a great panel. And Stacy, I have to thank you again because, frankly, Wendy and Bo are Stacy's friends that she coerced into
coming. They're more like smart people I call when I'm lost and confused. I would love to have them be my friends.
Oh, well, we're all friends now.
We are.
So, Stacy, because you cover this field, you're very well aware of all the risks and hazards, yet you have loaded your home with Internet of Things devices.
I've thrown caution to the wind.
What do you do for yourself? What do you tell family and friends about security?
Sure. So I always change the password on any device that I bring in. Most of my devices are actually modern enough that they force me to do it. So, and that makes me happy. I don't get irritated when they're like, hey, by the way, this is a crappy password. Try again. I'm like, Thank you, okay. Nice device. Like I said, I look for things that are over-the-air updatable. And I also, this is really simple. When I want to buy a device, I Google it first, and I check to see, has it been hacked? And more importantly, how has the company handled it? So have they ignored it? Sometimes if I'm feeling extra fancy, I'll be like, hey, do they have a bug bounty? Do they even have an email people can look at? That's hard to do if you buy this stuff on impulse. So, you know, maybe don't make your connected devices an impulse buy. And from there, I basically have a password manager. I follow those kind of things. And I know that I could get hacked.
Right.
So there's, like, I don't have cameras in my home because that does kind of freak me out a little bit.
We didn't talk about credit monitoring, but I'm you know, yesterday, Lisa, I pay for a credit monitoring service, which, you know, some people say as of dubious value. But yesterday, Lisa got a message from them saying, we saw your information on the dark web, and it was associated with Kickstarter because Kickstarter had a breach. And she said, what should I do about this? That's part of the problem I think a lot of people have. What do I do about this? I happen to know that Kickstarter had a breach, so I said, well, you might want to change your Kickstarter password, and if you have a credit card associated with them, maybe you want to change that. Those notifications don't give you that kind of information. Do you have a credit monitoring service?
I don't.
No, and I think that a lot of people, if they have it, it's because Equifax gave them a free one for a year, right?
I have. There are companies that, and again, this is part of being a journalist, and I don't think they serve individuals, but you can ask them to check the dark web or...
Right.
I hate saying the dark web. That feels so... it could be out in the open. Who knows?
That's a very media term, yeah. Isn't it? Like where the evil people live.
Like my airline frequent flyer mile thing could have leaked. I don't know. And right. So I have them check for my passwords and...
A lot of banks will do that too, yeah. And credit cards and so forth. Yeah. But what do you think of credit card monitoring? Do you do that? Do you care?
I don't do credit card monitoring either, but I have with each of the agencies put a freeze on my credit.
That seems like a very good thing to do.
And it's
not free, unfortunately.
I think it's
free in some states.
It's free in some states.
In California, it's $30, and then to take it off, it's $30, which is infuriating.
Oof. Yes, that is infuriating. Maybe a tip is if you call them up and report that you think it was your card number,
then they have to
stolen,
give it to
and
you.
They have to,
yeah,
right, which is a part of a law in the U.S.
Right.
So that's a simple hack.
Oh, they don't verify it.
I think just reporting that
is
they
sufficient.
Have to then
nice.
Right, so that may be a way around the
a useful hack.
Or you could flash your credit card number again on the show.
Yeah. No, a credit freeze is actually a really good tool. It may cost money, it may not, but that's a very good tool. What else do you do?
In addition to that, password managers are great. That's one of the first things I do when somebody asks me is go get a password manager, a good one, particularly one where it keeps the information on your own computer, maybe backs it up to the cloud.
But encrypted if it does.
Encrypted,
right?
Absolutely. Have a strong password for that. And then you don't necessarily even need to change that one very often, and right. It just takes care of the passwords in the back end is one, number one. Number two, update everything. Phones, as soon as there's an update for it, hit the update, laptops, et cetera. I also recommend a service that Troy Hunt has. It's a free service, Have I Been Pwned? And that acts like the dark
That's your
web
dark
password.
Web search
That's
right there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's free. You just go... Give them your email address or contact info, and they'll tell you when.
Have I been pwned.com?
PWNED.
Yeah,
I think.
Yeah.
Has a hacker taken over Have I Been Pwned spelled correctly? Because then that would be
domains
pretty savvy.
Yeah.
So just tell me your credit card number, and I'll tell you if you've been hacked.
Yeah. It's brilliant. Hold on. Nobody, take this off the air.
And then I think one thing that you mentioned, Stacey, is. Ask questions when you're going to buy things. So ask, is this updatable?
Right.
What is the security of this? One of the things that I learned in going through some of the work that I've done is actually retail outlets are very sensitive to customers asking questions, right? So if you ask security questions, they'll do more training of their staff. They'll look more into the things that they buy
like that.
And put on the shelves. Even like car manufacturers, right? Or physicians, or whatever your point of contact is.
What's your security?
Security is? I'm concerned.
Yeah. Yeah. We actually bought a car and we did ask, like, is this over the air updatable?
I bet you're the first person that ever asked that too.
come on, someone else has asked.
No, I bet you're the only one.
Okay.
I bet you this. What did the salesperson do? Did he?
I don't know.
Yeah.
He said, well, I'll look into that.
Yeah, I'll find out for you. Let me ask my manager.
And then one last thing that Stacey also mentioned is impulse buys on connected technology. And there was a...
anyone would ever do that.
Ian Fairchild, he was with the Atlantic Council at the time, wrote a strategy for DoD IoT security. And the number one thing that he had in that was the idea of connection by exception. It doesn't have to be connected. Don't. And when it does need to be connected, only for that time window. It may be a bit extreme for a lot of people, but it gets to the idea of impulse buying something that's connected, like an internet-connected stove, for instance. You might not need that, right?
You do. You really do.
No, you do. She talked me into an oven that's internet-connected.
I have an internet-connected oven, and I love that thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, how about you, Wendy? What do you do?
Well, to be real honest, I had a friend who worked for a credit monitoring company, and he just signed me up for lifetime credit monitoring for free. So that's the thing you should do. Make friends with a security person. that's your best security plan.
I think knowing a hacker is a very good plan.
Yeah.
Keeping on their good side.
But you know, you have to think about how to secure not only the things that you buy, but also how to teach your kids about security when they're growing up, how to help your parents as they age, and negotiate everything in between. So for example, one of my kids, when he was like 3 or 4, was playing on the computer, and we found him in the middle of downloading and installing a browser plugin.
Bonzi buddy.
And he couldn't even read yet. But
they got him young.
So here's how it happened. He discovered that, you know, when something pops up a window, there are two choices, and usually one of them is outlined, meaning it's the default choice.
Yeah, yeah.
So he discovered that if he clicked on that one, it would make the window go away, and he could get back to what he was doing.
Smart kid.
So he got all the way through downloading and starting to install a plugin until he got to the EULA, the End User License Agreement, and there was no highlighted default choice between agree and disagree. And so he got stuck and didn't know what to do, and that's where we found him.
Wow.
So the flip
Reading
side of
the
that
EULA.
Is my daughter, she when anything pops up on her computer, she comes running down the stairs with the laptop. Mom, what do I do?
Good for her. But that's important.
It is good, but it's also kind of like, there's a lot of pop-ups happening on websites.
There is a lot. And one of the problems that we have in technology is that we have not planned very well for the people's life cycle of owning and being secure and securing their data from when they're minors and parents have to manage their security for them to when they turn 18 and we hand over control of their digital affairs to the kids. When somebody becomes disabled, even temporarily, and can't handle their affairs, the closest that we have today is a password manager that you can, where you can share your passwords with your loved one, but it means that they have to log in as you. And that conflicts directly with those businesses' desire to figure out whether it's really you logging in. So you run up against their fraud analytics. And so it isn't real true delegation.
That's a really interesting
It's a big problem.
Yeah, I've set that up with my wife, emergency access.
Yeah.
If I pass away, she can access my last pass. But you raise a really interesting point. She will then be logging into those places as me.
If you log into Capital One, are they going to say, "Wait, we happen to know that you're not Leo"?
Yeah,
and you know, and we're kicking you out. So
that's a big. That's a good.
That's
point.
Another thing that we have to figure out how to do.
This
how to
is
do
also
delegation
new.
Properly.
We don't have any history in this, so we don't know what to do.
We have something similar, which is power of attorney.
Yeah.
Which is a different concept, but
But we need a digital
power
of attorney.
And it's not digital. Yeah.
We need a digital power of attorney.
Yeah.
Wendy, thank you so much for being here. Early morning in Austin, but I appreciate your coming from Duo Security. Is there anything you want to tell people about or plug as long as we've got you?
Well, you know, our CEO, Doug Song, has described cybersecurity as the biggest geopolitical issue of our times. And so, you know, we're trying to address it as a company. I think all of us realize this and are trying to address it in our own ways. But I think it's very important that we keep these discussions going.
I agree. Thank you, Wendy. Bo Woods, so nice to have you, a Cyber Safety Innovation Fellow for the Scowcroft Center for Strategy and Security. Can people go to I Am the Cavalry and get help?
Yeah, I am the Cavalry. We're a fairly open initiative. Anybody can kind of come up, come online and start hanging out, talking with us.
Nice.
The idea is that it's not just one person or a handful of people. Everyone needs to be in charge of their own kind of cyber safety.
So true. So true.
And so we invite everybody to kind of connect and learn more, as well as get involved and push the digital design towards a safer posture.
And you do a podcast of your own, am I right?
I have in the past done several podcasts.
You don't have one now?
Not anymore.
You could have plugged it.
I could have plugged it if I did.
You want to start one?
Maybe.
Let's start one.
There you
Let's
go. Yeah.
There you go. That's how easy it is.
Episode zero right here.
Yeah.
Watch it.
Right.
And, of course, Stacy, it's always a pleasure. It's fun to come to your neck of the woods for a change. Stacy Higginbotham does a great newsletter you should all subscribe to, Stacy on IoT.com, and, of course, her podcast with Kevin Toefel, and every Wednesday with This Week in Google. Thank you for being here. I appreciate it.
I'm sad I didn't get to do my own plug there, Leo.
Plug something.
You did. Well, I was going to say, Bo didn't tell people, but on the I Am the Cavalry website, they actually have some best practices for the automotive industry, for the healthcare industry. So, and those are actually really common sense, easy to think about. So go check those out. I actually apply some of them in my smart home life. So.
That makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's all kind of the same. Yeah. I am the cavalry.
.org. Yep.
Okay. And I want to thank everybody who came to our event. The tacos are done, so I think we can just close this thing off. Really appreciate having you in our audience. And, of course, a very hearty thanks to our friends at Capital One for bringing us to Austin, for putting together the Capital One House at South by Southwest. There's a long schedule, a big list of all the things that are going to be happening here. It's going to be a real party for the next week at South by. I hope you get a chance, if you're in the area, to come down and see what's going on. I'm Leo Laporte. Thanks for watching. And maybe we'll do this again next year. What do you think?
Yeah.
On it.
All right. We'll see you then. Bye-bye.